KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Good Friday morning. This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell sitting in for Marcy Silliman this morning. At the end of a week that was packed with news, our regular panel of news journalists will be on hand joining us at 10 o'clock this morning to go over all of it. But we start today with a look at the Washington state budget. A tentative two-year budget deal was reached in Olympia yesterday. The $33.6 billion budget allocates an additional $1 billion for public schools. The deal comes in time to avoid a partial government shutdown. Over 20,000 state employees received temporary layoff notices this last Monday, warning them that if there was no budget deal, that meant they had no work come July. Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and columnist covering state politics for the Everald Herald. Thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning.
What a week, Jerry.
Oh, well, yeah, it started slow. Actually, it started with predictions from Governor Jay Inslee on Monday. I think it was 2:30 in the afternoon, and he said a budget deal is imminent. And then by Wednesday, he was telling reporters, or his staff was telling reporters, not only where they sent out the layoff notices, they had started calling people and contacting them, saying your reservations for overnight camping in state parks could be canceled, events might be canceled, services to human services and health care programs might be suspended, et cetera. And then yesterday morning, handshake and a deal.
Sounds like a whole lot of work. Leading up to it, a lot of warnings that weren't necessarily needed.
Well, the shutdown warnings were needed maybe not in the public way, and it was probably part of the negotiating process. But you know, if you're going to shut down a state government, you just can't wake up Monday morning on July 1st and send out an email and say, "Hey, go on home, we're shut down." You've really got to do some planning. So I think they had to, you know, it's contingency planning for that, you know, unforeseen moment that came within 72 hours of happening. And so now, but then the flip side is once they shook hands on a deal and told the world we have a deal, those name faceless and unknown staff members proceed to work and work and work, writing up the 482-page document that is now going to be voted on today by both the House and the Senate.
Yeah, and yesterday, Ross Hunter, who's the House Appropriations Chairman, said that he considered it a very delicate agreement that could still fall apart. Why would it fall apart, Jerry?
Well, there are still a couple of provisions, or I'll call them the tough nuts to crack, that yesterday, because they couldn't find agreement on a couple items, they just said, "All right, we'll agree to take it out of the budget, and you folks go in the corner and keep talking, and if you can reach agreement on language, then bring it back to us and we'll stick it in." I mean, the plan here is that they vote on it and all their members will just sit back and say yes or no. They won't make any amendments and that they're done fighting. But, you know, it's the Senate is a 25-24 break in terms of the Senate Majority Coalition Caucus and the Democratic minority. So, you know, it only takes one member of that majority coalition to, you know, change their mind and maybe it doesn't go through.
What do you think the likelihood of that is?
I think it's very unlikely. I think people are, not only are they getting tired, but I think they also took a deep breath after the announcement of the deal and said, all right, we're done fighting over everything. We've got many things that we've accomplished and many we won't, but it's 2014 is literally just around the corner. It's closer than they ever thought they'd be. So I think they're done fighting and they want to move along. I think the public's concern, or at least those who watch it really closely, is are they suddenly going to move so quickly that they make mistakes, whether it's in the budget or in the, you know, probably two dozen bills that have to be passed to actually carry out the budget. There's going to be so much new language and so many new versions of bills coming out for the first time and being voted on. You're bound to have errors that they're going to have to fix again come January.
Well, and the one part of the budget that's getting the big headlines this morning is the $1 billion that went to education. Where did that money actually go?
Well, the charting that has been done, the $1 billion in education is focused on that Supreme Court case last year and what's called the McCleary decision. And that there are sort of 10, maybe 11 elements of basic education, for example, the materials and supplies of schools, the bus transportation. These are all things the state is supposed to pay for and local districts have been paying for. So when you look at the $1 billion, Over the next 2 years, the state's going to provide another $374 million towards the materials and supplies and operating costs of schools. They're going to provide $130 million for buses. And you know, they're going to spend $104 million for reducing the size of classes in the lower grades. They're going to add another $90 million to have full-day kindergarten at more schools around the state. And you know, there's $20 million for bilingual education. All of these are pieces of what the legislature has said we consider a basic education. The Supreme Court said, well, you call it basic ed, you got to pay for it, and you haven't been doing that. So this is a down payment. The court figures it's about $4 billion, maybe $5 billion, to actually cover all the costs. So they have a lot of work to do in the future.
Now, we're going to go more in depth with you on this on Monday, but I just want to ask you the final question. How would you consider Governor Inslee's leadership through all these negotiations this week?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell who's doing what in the negotiations. I think he is going to this is a tough one because he was not meeting in a room with the House and Senate budget negotiators face to face. It wasn't that wasn't going on. It was more shuttle diplomacy in and out of his office, one party, the other party, one caucus, the other caucus. So I can't quite tell whether how much impact on the final decision he had compared to the lawmakers themselves kind of realizing they needed to agree and on their own as opposed to under pressure from the governor.
Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and columnist covering state politics for the Everett Herald. Talk to you Monday, Jerry.
All right, talk to you then.
All right, thanks. This is Weekday. News reporters are calling yesterday's Senate vote on immigration reform a rare example of bipartisanship. The Senate voted yesterday 68-32 to overhaul the nation's immigration system, showing strong support for the 1,200-page bill created by the Gang of Eight. The bill now heads to the House. Joining us to talk more about it is Jill Jackson, Capitol Hill News producer for CBS News. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Katie.
So is this a rare example of bipartisanship?
Well, it absolutely is. We have not seen this kind of bipartisan vote, you know, well over 60 near 70 votes in the Senate on a policy issue in a very, very long time, especially pretty much since the 2010 elections, which gave us a divided Washington. It has been nothing but divisions and fights, and we've also been in a tough time as a country where we've been lurching from one budget crisis to the next. So this is really the first policy bill, major policy bill, to gain bipartisan support in a couple years.
Why do you think it was this bill?
Well, the bill is very large, 1,200 pages. It would massively change the United States immigration system. You would have the illegal immigrants who are currently in the country would become eligible after a very long time, 13 years for citizenship. They would be eligible sooner for legalization and certain work programs and whatnot. And they try to make it easier for employers to hire immigrants. They also try to make it easier through an E-Verify electronic program for employers to check the legal status of their potential employees. It would also dramatically change conditions at the southern border. The provision originally many thought was pretty beefy, but it's going to beef up security on the southern border by quite a bit, doubling the number of Border Patrol agents that they were planning on putting at the border from 20,000 to 40,000.
Well, how did the vote go down? I know that the procedure they took was different than usual.
Well, one thing that was unusual about the vote is that normally when they vote, the senators walk in, they scramble in from their offices or whatever meeting they were in, and they just go up to the desk in the front of the chamber and tell the clerk how they want to vote. This vote was far more formal, which Majority Leader Harry Reid just wanted to signify what a good deal it is. So you saw the senators all seated at their desks, and Vice President Joe Biden was actually in the chair presiding over the vote. And they did a true roll call vote where they would read the senator's name and they would have to say yay or nay. And they did that with all 100 senators to signify the importance. And they do that very occasionally. They did it. They do it on Supreme Court justice nominations. They do it. They did it on the health care bill. It's usually a very major policy bill or a justice for them to go to such measures.
Now, of course, they're calling it a historic vote for the Senate, but it isn't expected to fare well in the House. What are you expecting?
I'm expecting it to go nowhere in the House. The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, reiterated yesterday that they are not going to bring up the Senate bill. They're going to do their own thing. We already had the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Bob Goodlatte of Virginia. He has been writing up small bills, one that deals with visas for high-skilled immigrants, one that deals with agriculture workers, another that deals with our, just in general, the country's visa system. And so he's been kind of doing a piecemeal approach. And that seems to be something that House conservatives are much more comfortable with. They don't like big comprehensive bills. That 1,200-page number is really scary to them. They also, it's important to keep in mind in the House, they don't have the same calculation that someone who's representing an entire state has when it comes to the changing demographics in this country. A lot of the districts they're representing are not as diverse as a full state is going to be, and a lot of House Republicans are more concerned about a primary challenge from the right than they are from the left. So all the conditions there are going to make it much more difficult. Then the House is going on recess next week. Speaker Boehner told members to go home and talk to their constituents about this issue. They're going to come back, and on July 10th, they will meet as a full GOP conference and really talk out the way forward, because certainly Speaker Boehner cannot do this on his own. He can't say, this is what we are going to do. He's going to need the support of a significant chunk of the GOP conference if he's going to get any immigration bill across the finish line, and that's going to be very difficult. Now, he said he will not bring a bill to the floor unless it has the majority of Republicans supporting it. So I believe we're in for a tough, long slog in the House, and it is by no means certain that we will see the two chambers reach any kind of agreement this year.
Well, given that fact, how should we as the citizenry feel about the, quote, historic vote that happened yesterday?
It's a major step. I mean, this is the first major immigration bill to pass since 1986. That's nearly 30 years. So it absolutely is significant. It was bipartisan. The Gang of Eight that wrote that bill in the House, numerous times we in the press were speculating that one person might ditch and get out. We didn't necessarily think that Marco Rubio would see it through. But they really defended their package and were willing to make key changes to make it work. And they all compromised. So it is a big deal. And, you know, what it does is it definitely does put pressure on the House to do something. And if the House passes any bill, then they can go to conference with the Senate and try to reach some sort of final agreement. But I suspect that if that does happen, we'll end up in that classic the classic fight over what happens with the illegal immigrants currently in the country, because House Republicans do not believe in a path to citizenship. Many are more comfortable with a path to some sort of legalization, but something short of citizenship. And you do that, and you're going to lose many Democrats. So it's going to be a fine balance, and I think ultimately that could be the fight.
Jill Jackson is the Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. Thanks so much for taking the time, Jill.
Thanks, Katie.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:21. Scientists are changing the way they think about cancer. We're going to find out how and why in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to 17 destinations in the Middle East. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
70 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 81 this afternoon with lots of sun. Tomorrow's forecast, sun with a high of 81, and then we're looking at sunny days and temperatures in the 70s and 80s, possibly even getting up into the 90s, all the way through next Thursday. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:22. Is your cat Chloe clawing the carpet, or your puppy Petey pruning the plants? If your pet is displaying troubling behavior, stick around. Pet trainer Steve Duno will be here to help you out in 10 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. A scientist at Johns Hopkins University has developed a mathematical model to better understand why some cancer tumors are resistant to cancer-fighting drugs. Science reporter Carl Zimmer joins us to explain this study. He's a science reporter and author whose weekly column, Matter, appears each Thursday in the New York Times. Thanks, Carl, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So in your article about this latest study, you start out by describing three pictures that Bert Vogelstein, a cancer geneticist at Johns Hopkins, found very haunting. Can you explain what those pictures were?
Yes. These are pictures that appeared in a scientific journal a couple years ago showing the effects of a drug, an anti-cancer drug, on a man who had melanoma. He had this very advanced case of skin cancer where you could see large tumors all over his body. And he took this drug. It's a new part of a new generation of cancer drugs that target cancer cells very precisely, go after particular proteins in the cancer cells. And it was really amazing. The second picture in the series shows his body, and he looks completely normal. His skin seems totally healthy. And you look at that and you say, wow. This man is cured. Unfortunately, the third picture shows the man a few weeks later. Cancer returned, and it ultimately, unfortunately, killed him. And the amazing thing to Dr. Vogelstein was that if you look at the first picture and the third picture, they're very close to a match. In other words, all of those tumors that had grown on the man's body, they had disappeared, and then they'd all come back. And so that really shows us that there's something incredibly evasive and powerful about cancer, and even our very best drugs can fail too often. And so Vogelstein and others want to find a way around that.
And, of course, that would be a heartbreaking thing to have happen to the patient and their family.
Absolutely.
Why did he end up teaming up with mathematicians to look at this problem?
Well, Vogelstein was actually a math major in college, and so he's always kind of had an appreciation for how mathematical equations can actually tell you important things about the real world. And, you know, if you think about a cancer tumor, you've got a bunch of cells that are growing, and they're growing at a certain rate, and they're also dying at a certain rate, and sometimes they're mutating, and that happens also at a certain rate. So you have all these things happening at these different rates. And if you can just come up with an equation that describes all of that, then you can actually understand the cancer much better than just, you know, every now and then looking at a biopsy. But this math is very sophisticated. And so he collaborated with one of the world's leaders in what's called mathematical biology, Martin Nowak at Harvard University.
So once they're able to figure out exactly how the cell are mutating, how is that applicable to the medicine that they're treating them with?
Well, what it does is it shows you why these kinds of drugs sometimes fail. So these targeted drugs, people may have heard of Gleevec, for example, these are different than previous generations of chemotherapy, which just kind of blasted any fast dividing cell, and then so that would actually affect you as your own tissues as well. Now they're looking at what happens when you give these drugs to people, and unfortunately, the fact is that cancer cells are mutating. Every time they divide, there's a chance that they mutate, and some of those mutations can make a cancer cell resist these drugs. And it turns out, based on these calculations, that you can show that actually once a tumor is detectable, once it's a few billion cells, there are already perhaps a couple thousand resistant cells in it, even before you start therapy. And so you might kill off all of the susceptible cells, but those resistant cells are going to grow the tumor back. And this is going to be a very hard thing to avoid.
Yeah, so with this mathematical model, they were able to predict exactly how quickly the tumor was going to return. What are they hoping to do with that prediction?
Well, they can test out different ways of using these drugs. I mean, these drugs clearly are effective, and certainly nobody would turn down, you know, a few months of extra life. But, you know, what we want is for cancer drugs to actually either cure us of cancer or give us a relatively long life. And so these scientists want to say, like, okay, well, if we look at these equations, can we come up with new sorts of strategies? And so one possibility is to use two different drugs, each one targeting a different protein. Now, doctors actually do this now without thinking about the math of it. What they do is they give people one of these drugs, and if it works, that's great, and then they don't have to do anything else. But if it fails, which unfortunately does too often, they'll go to a second of these targeted therapies, and they'll try that one out. And what the math shows, Dr. Vogelstein and Dr. Nowak have shown, is that that's going to fail as well, because basically you're just replaying that same evolutionary game. The cancer is resistant to the first drug, you use that, and then the tumor comes back, and then within the new tumor, there are going to be some cells that are resistant to the second drug. So really what you're going to have to do is figure out ways of using two or more of these drugs at once.
What has been the reaction to this study from doctors?
You know, doctors that I've talked to about this have been really intrigued by it. I mean, certainly, you know, Dr. Vogelstein is one of the world's leading cancer geneticists. But the thing is that this approach is just a bit different from the traditional medical culture approach to cancer, where, you know, you're really just, you know, you do trials, you try the drug in a dish on some cells, see how that works, go and try it on mice, see how that works, try it on people, see how that works, and you're just looking at the data. Whereas if you step back and look at it as a mathematical equation, you might be able to see things that are there that are harder to see in that data. So I think it's going to be a while before these cultures come together. But, you know, if this mathematical approach can really lead to some important insights and lead people to new treatments that they wouldn't have come up with otherwise, and I think that will really make it more a part of how we deal with cancer.
Carl Zimmer is a science reporter and author whose weekly column Matter appears each Thursday in the New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us to tell us about it.
Thank you.
This is Weekday. And now we shift to something else entirely, from cancer to pet care. Steve Duno joins us. He's trained thousands of dogs and a good number of cats, and he's the author of 18 different books, including his latest, Last Dog on the Hill, The Extraordinary Life of Lou. And you join us to help people with their pet questions this morning.
So many pets, so little time, huh?
Also joined by Flavio, who's the eldest dog in the Duno household, who's currently standing on my lap, probably waiting for one of these four treats you just passed me here. But I'm going to wait. I'm going to make him wait.
Yeah, make him wait. It's good.
And
anticipation.
If you have a question you want answered about a cat or a dog in your life that's causing you some trouble, give us a call at 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW, or toll-free 1-800-289-5869, 1-800-289-KUOW. So while we're waiting for the calls to start lining up, and we already have a few coming in, so if you have a question, get on it. I was interested in an article you recently wrote for Modern Dog magazine, which was about our nation's neutering policies.
Oh, yeah, among other things, yeah.
And you start thinking about the question by asking where shelter puppies come from.
Uh-huh.
So where do they come from?
Well, they come from unfortunate breedings most of the time. They come from purebred animals who are allowed to breed with other purebred animals, and they create mixed breeds. Most mixed breeds out there are have at least one purebred parent. So that's what's really going on, and it's pretty fascinating that it's still happening. But there's lots of them, and they're always there, and it's an interesting phenomenon, and I guess you were interested in my comments on why do we have such a prevalent neutering policy when it comes to these shelter dogs, when so many of these shelter dogs can actually be great dogs and maybe they should be bred as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that, I always think harken back to my old dog Lou, who really should have been bred. I mean, you want the Einsteins of the world to be to breed.
And what was he?
He was a Rottweiler Shepherd mix.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, you have the stigma of breeding a mixed breed dog. And it is a stigma. I think it's a prejudice in a way.
Well, you also talk about there being a bunch of inferior dogs in the shelters right now.
Yeah, there's a lot.
What's an inferior dog? Aren't all dogs supposed to be lovely and
well, spiritually,
good friends?
There is bad breeding that goes on. If you take a dog that has demonstrative problems, behavior problems, and breed it with another dog who has problems, the chances of getting bad, quote unquote, puppies is pretty high. And you know, I'm being kept pretty busy these days with dogs, shelter dogs, who get into the hands of well-meaning, loving people who are just not up to it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of dog-on-dog aggression right now, and aggression in general. Used to be that house training was the problem I dealt with, or destructive behavior, digging holes. Now it's almost all people with dogs they've rescued at maybe 2 or 3 years of age, pit mixes, what have you. And they can't take them out for walks because they're being aggressive toward other dogs and people.
So you think that this is a product of our neutering policies?
Not exactly. It's a product of how can I say this? It's a product of people really waking up to the need of these dogs to be adopted. But it's also a product of the fact that these dogs are being created by people who don't know what they're doing. I mean, you've got so many pits now because people raise pits for bait dogs and for fighting, and there's a lot of reservation dogs that come in, and there's just strays that come in, and you have no idea what their histories are. And these dogs are being adopted more and more and more today, which is a good thing, but they are questionable so far as their behavior. So my question is, and at the same time, I'm sorry, at the same time, there's sort of a stigma about purebred dogs. People think that it's almost immoral to get a purebred dog these days. And it's not. Without purebred dogs, we wouldn't have these mixed breeds. I mean, they would cease to be. So my whole argument is you want to encourage the breeding of good dogs, mostly purebred. You want to encourage that to prevent the what I see as an epidemic right now of poorly bred dogs in the shelters.
Hmm. Have you ever adopted one of these poorly bred dogs?
Well, Flavia was a stray.
Yes.
Rico, who you've met, is a 6-year-old pit shepherd mix off the reservation. Louis was the feral offspring of guard dogs on a marijuana grow. So, yes, I have.
You specialize
I am a sucker.
In difficult dogs.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I'm sort of an expert at this, and so many people out there aren't. And I just spent this week, you know, doing evaluations on 3 or 4 dogs and with varying problems. But it's almost the default problem now, that they all have aggression problems. So it's a lot of work.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, why don't we go to the phones, and I don't know if Isaac in West Seattle actually has an aggressive dog, but he does have a dog that's jumping on his furniture.
Uh-oh.
Hi, Isaac.
Hi there. Yes, my dog is not aggressive, and I'm very grateful for that.
Good.
But one of the problem behaviors that I've been trying to deal with, I'm kind of stumped by, is that when I'm in the house, no problem. Dog is not, like, getting into anything or jumping on any furniture that shouldn't be on. However, when I leave, the dog always finds a way to get on couches, even if I put objects up there to try to discourage her from getting up there. And unfortunately, it leads to, you know, furniture damage and such. And so I'm wondering if you have any ideas about why she works so hard to get into these uncomfortable places that make them, you know.
What kind of dog is she, Isaac?
She's a 45-pound boxer pit pointer mix.
Okay.
Wow.
All right, so she's very capable of getting up on almost anything at this point.
Yes, she's very athletic and agile.
Well, how is her overall behavior in the house when you're gone?
When I'm gone?
Yeah. Does she destroy anything? Does she?
No. No destruction. Nothing really that unhealthy.
Okay. Is she getting up on a piece of furniture to look out a window, or is it just for comfort's sake, you think?
It seems to be for comfort's sake.
Okay. How's her training?
She is fairly well trained, you know, has all the basics down, has gone through basic behavioral training.
Okay. No, well, that's good, and she's not destructive. So usually in this situation, what I do is I get the dog a really nice dog bed and encourage her to use that. And then I teach an up and off command with a dog so I can control the behavior. Okay, and I'm sure you can do that in a couple of weeks. It's probably a very smart dog. But then you have to remove her ability to go up on that sofa entirely for at least 6 or 8 weeks.
Wow.
So she either needs to not be in that room for that length of time, or you just simply need to put things on the sofa that completely prohibit her from getting up on it. And then the only alternative she has in that room would be this nice cush dog bed.
Right.
Okay.
So it's all about making it. So train an on and off command, and also make it really unappealing to get.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you have a couple of boxes filled with, you know, books or something on the sofa, she's not going to be able to get up. And if you can keep her off for about 8 weeks, usually that will extinguish the behavior. It takes a couple of months to do that.
Okay, cool.
All right.
So there's definitely a longer time frame than I realized. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Isaac. Well, let's take a quick break with Steve Duno in our studios, trained thousands of dogs, and he can help you with yours if you call us at 206-543-5869, 206-543-KOW. And Flavio's also here. I may give him a dog biscuit during the break. We'll be right back. This is Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from King County Solid Waste Division, encouraging families to recycle food scraps and food-soiled paper, meat, fish, vegetable and fruit trimmings, bread, eggshells, and coffee grounds can be recycled in the yard waste cart. Online at recyclefood.com.
70 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says it's going to be sunny today with a high of 81. It's 9:40.
We know that a lot of people are intimidated by car repair.
So we always try to avoid jargon and answer questions in human terms.
But if your injectors are tired and old and worn out, they
like
will,
my brother.
They will leak when they're not supposed to. And what happens is...
They're like my brother.
We're Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers. For down-to-earth advice, join us for Car Talk.
Car repair advice tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and we'll get back to your pet repair advice in a moment.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Asian Art Museum, presenting Words on Water, Writers from India in Conversation, June 26th through the 28th. Visiting writers dialogue with local writers on their recent works in fiction and nonfiction. Information at seattleartmuseum.org/gardenercenter.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell, sitting in the studio with Steve Duno, who's a dog trainer, cat trainer, author of 18 books, including his latest book, Last Dog on the Hill, The Extraordinary Life of Lou, and his dog Flavio is here, the eldest dog in his household. And we're taking your pet questions for dogs and cats, and we go straight back to the phones with Drew in West Seattle. Hi, Drew.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Hey, Drew.
So you got a dog?
I have a dog, yeah. He's a shepherd pit mix, we think, and he's probably 65 pounds or so. But our issue is he's like the calmest dog in the entire world all day. But when it's feeding time, he just freaks out. He'll start running around the house and, you know, tearing up our wood floors and jumping on things. So we have really no idea how to restrict that behavior.
Okay. So there's a real, you've built up a real anticipation of this, of the feeding time for the, what's the dog's name?
His name's Bosley.
Bosley, okay. Okay, and he's 65. How old is he?
He's probably about 7 now.
Oh, he's 7. Okay, how long has he been doing this?
You know, he's always kind of done it, but he's gotten a lot worse in the last couple of years.
And why do you think that is?
You can tell his, his anxiety level seems like goes up a lot more, and now he's, you know, he jumps up and he's running around and he just acts so much differently.
All right. The first thing, Drew, is make sure that he's healthy. Sometimes an increased food drive and increased activity can point to hyperthyroidism. So it would probably be a good bet to just get his thyroid levels checked. That's first. Second, you feed him once a day?
Twice a day. Oh. He gets one cup twice a day.
Okay, that's interesting. And the crazy behavior is at both meals or just in the evening?
It's at both meals. So when we wake up, you know, first thing, he starts freaking out. And then starting about 4 p.m., he's back at it.
All right, you need to try to desensitize that feeding period. So normally I say to people, don't free feed your dog. Feed at specific times because it builds the food drive. But it seems that Bosley has a hyper food drive. So why don't you consider perhaps doing a free feeding thing or feeding him 3 or 4 times a day, only smaller meals, and see if that affects his appetite.
Okay, so the free feeding thing is just leaving food out in his bowl?
Yeah, now I have a feeling that he's probably going to gobble up everything and there won't be anything there.
Exactly.
So you'd want to just maybe put a cup out and let him eat it, and then a couple hours, 3 or 4 hours later, put a half a cup out and let him eat it. See if you spread it out during the day, if you can deflate that food drive. The only issue with that is it might mess with his house training, so be careful with it. Do it gradually.
Okay.
See if that helps. And it also sounds like he needs a little more exercise.
Yeah, that could definitely.
Yeah, get him out on a run or throw a frisbee or a ball for him.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Drew. We have an email here from Jason, who also has a dog issue. He says, our mix, a corgi and a terrier, has separation anxiety at times, especially when it rains. She especially goes after the doorknobs because she knows that's how we open the door. She also takes her stress out on the door molding. Now, she gets plenty of exercise, and I don't really want to leave her in a crate. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, if it rains... Flavio, right here, gets nerved out, nervous with rain and certainly with thunder. And when it gets really bad, I do put him in his crate or I'll put him in a quiet, dark room just to chill him out. What you don't want to do is you do not want to console a dog through any kind of nervous activity because that actually will reinforce the behavior. So if you can either put the dog in a calm, quiet area during this episode, or get the dog involved in something else to try and distract him, those would be your two best bets. But you also want to try to remove whatever kind of whatever objects he might be destroying. You don't want him in the room where he can get to the doorknob or the molding. If you have to put him in a crate, you do. If there's a room that's a little more dog friendly, dog proof, put him there. But try to distract him out of it. See if he will. Corgi Terrier mix probably wants to fetch a ball. So see if he'll be distracted out of his concerns.
Carolyn's in Matthews Beach. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
Hey, Carolyn.
Hi. So we have a question. We are thinking about getting a dog. We'd like to get a dog, but we both work. And so I'm hearing a whole array of opinions on that. The people was like, yeah, you know, you get a dog, they deal with it. You know, you get home, they'll be fine as long as you play with them in your home.
Nah, not really.
Not an option. So exactly. And so I'm wondering, you know, kind of more the psyche of the dog as well. But, you know, what if two people are working, how could they also have a dog?
Yeah, yeah. What kind of job do you have? Do they allow you to take your dog to work?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Neither of us, actually. We're in the offices, which, yeah.
Do you have a yard?
Yeah, we actually have a pretty, for Seattle, pretty big quarter acre.
Oh, okay. So you could build a really nice covered dog run.
Yep.
Okay. That might be an option. You might want to adopt an older dog that's already got his chops down. You know, if you go up to Noah, where is it, up in Burlington, or I forget where it is up north, it's a really nice place that adopts out older dogs, and they already know, you know, the ways of the world, so that might be an option. And if, you know, it's really not extremely healthy to keep a dog in the house for 9 hours a day. At least if he's outside in a covered dog run, there'd be some activity, and he'd watch the birds and the squirrels, but he'd still be safe because he's in a dog run. You know, dogs adapt. So, I mean, I've owned dogs who, I mean, Flavio right now will sleep half the day at home, and I don't have to worry about him. But certainly when if you adopt a dog, you want at least a few weeks off to help that dog integrate into your family. So, do it during a vacation if you can.
Okay. And we were actually thinking of having a dog door so it could have access in and out of the house throughout the day.
Yeah, that's an option as well. I just I kind of like the dog run a little better. When you have the if you get a larger dog and you have a doggy door, there's always a chance of someone slipping in.
Yeah.
And there's always a chance that it might affect the dog's house training. If the dog can go in and out whenever it wants, it doesn't really understand in versus out. So sometimes it can be a problem. But think about an older dog.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, or a cat.
Thanks. Got a cat.
Okay.
Thanks, Carolyn. Hans is interested in knowing where the name Flavio comes from.
I thought Hans would ask that. Flavio was named after a man named Flavio Briatore, was the race car director for Formula One race director for Renault years ago.
That was his guess.
Yeah, because, very nice.
I know.
Very nice. Because when Flavio was young, I don't know if you remember, he was a leaper and a runner, and he was leaping 6-foot fences and taking off on us. So.
And how old is Flavio today?
Flavio is going to celebrate his 16th birthday.
Wow.
So
he's still looking good.
Yeah, he's looking okay.
Della says that she has a 3-year-old cat named Maddie who is very food driven. They've had her since she was a kitten. She steals cartons of chicken stock, frozen meat that's defrosting in the sink, anything that's left on a kitchen counter. They have to be very diligent about not leaving any food on the counters or in a backpack or she'll find it. They feed her twice a day at the vet's recommendation, a high-quality wet food, and she's a good weight according to the vet. So they started using a squirt bottle when they caught her on the counters, but nothing seems to deter this thief, cat food thief.
Well, you're leaving chicken on the in the sink and in the counter.
Well, it's got to defrost.
Hey, they're three-dimensional creatures. Okay, so they're going to get anywhere they can get. And if, you know, there's a chicken thigh in the sink, I'm going to get it if I'm a cat. So make sure, I'm sure your vet has looked into this, but cats with really high food drives can also be hyperthyroid, so have that checked. But just it's a simple function of denial. Don't let the cat keep these things out of the cat's reach. Keep them in the refrigerator to defrost over a longer period of time, or in counters behind doors, whatever you can. I mean, this cat likes to eat, and that's a good thing for cats because you can teach the cat tricks. Cats with high food drives will learn tricks for food, so you can always pick up my Showbiz Tricks for Cats book and
that's true. That's
teach
true.
The cat some tricks.
Maybe you can make a little money on the side.
Yeah,
a little. Hope that helps, Della. Yeah. Maybe time for about one more call. We'll go with James and Kent. Hey, James.
Holy cow, here I am.
Here you are.
Hey, James.
We're thinking about getting a dog. We have about 1/4 acre, and it's near a forested area on a double dead-end street, but we don't want to put a fence up yet, so we were thinking about the invisible fence.
Yeah, they
breeding a dog, getting a young dog, if it's in the yard and the fence works, is that fair to the animal?
It, you know, they work for some dogs, they don't work for others. Dogs with very high territorial drives will just blow right through them, like Rotties and German Shepherds will just blow right through them. And they also don't keep other dogs out, so other right. dogs can come in whenever they want. So I'm not a huge fan of the invisible fence. I would, if you could train the dog with a good recall command and teach boundary training, that would be a much longer but better solution to the problem. It can't hurt, but you're not going to keep a lot of dogs in, and you're not going to keep any dogs out with it.
Right, right. Yeah. If my dog got out, would this prevent it from returning? Or could it?
It could, yeah. Your dog, yeah. If the collar is functioning, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You
should go old school. Just go old school. Teach boundary training and a really, really good recall.
All right.
Yeah.
That's what I want to know.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, James. Maybe one more quick one. Okay. Angie's got four cats. Cat number four just arrived in December and fit in really well, except for the most submissive cat in the family. Now, this new cat really wants to be friends with the shy one, but the shy one just doesn't seem to be up for it. And he can't seem to give up. He just sits and stares at the shy one until it gets nervous and upset. So she says she has a stalking cat. Is there any tips for what
Yeah,
be
you know,
doing?
Four cats is a strange dynamic. Usually two cats that know each other well is great. Three cats can be a problem, and four cats can really get interesting.
So she needs to return one.
No, I wouldn't do that. I just let them work it out on their own over the next 6 months. Usually, it'll find its they'll each find their place. Just look for really extreme aggression, which I don't think is going to happen. But let them work it out. It's just like having four kids with different personalities.
Steve Dino has trained thousands of dogs and a good number of cats. He's written 18 books, including the latest, Last Dog on the Hill, The Extraordinary Life of Lou. Boy.
Yeah.
Quite a title. Extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah.
Flavia the dog is his eldest dog, asleep here on the floor, or just waking up.
Interesting.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, love it.
This is Weekday.
And now.
This is the sound of the week. The sound of the week. Listener Laura sent us that sound. That's the sound of her 11-year-old daughter, Eden, doing cups. Cups is a percussive rhythm combining clapping, padding on the floor, and tapping a cup against the floor. Apparently, it became popular after Anna Kendrick did it in the movie Pitch Perfect. Eden spent about 4 hours one Saturday afternoon learning how to play it. Not bad. If you're hearing interesting sounds, record 30 seconds of it and send it to us weekday@kyw.org with Sound of the Day in the subject line. And Nick Bond joins us now with a look at the weekend weather forecast. Hi, Nick.
How you there?
Good. Nick is the Washington State climatologist who works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. It's looking like a hot one, Nick.
Yeah, this weekend not so bad. Today, low 80s. Tomorrow, a little warmer yet, low to mid-80s, and then mid-80s on Sunday, where it's really going to get hot for around here on Monday and Tuesday, it looks like. And so right now, Monday is probably going to be the hottest day, and it looks every indication it's going to get into the 90s.
The 90s.
And that will be a record for the day, the all-time record at SeaTac. Going back to 48 is 87, and we may also set the record high low temperature, which is 60 for that day. Last night it was 61, and it looks like this is going to be one of those times when the nights are kind of warm too.
Well, we've been having days where it's muggy outside, but it's cloudy. Is it going to be cloudy in 90?
No, it's going to be mostly sunny. During the days, Sunday into early next week, there are going to be some Probably some scattered thunder showers in the Cascades, and some of the clouds from that may drift over. And there's even a very slight chance of some of those thunderstorms drifting off into the foothill regions or even over the populated regions of Puget Sound. But it's more going to be, you know, sunny days and really hot for this time of year.
Now, that's not necessarily something we're used to around here, so is there...
Right, and this is kind of early in the season for a heat wave here. The State Climate Office has recently done some research on this, and almost all our heat waves are in the kind of after the 4th of July and through mid-August. And so this is, it's not unprecedented, but it's unusual.
So is it going to have any, I mean, we don't have air conditioners now. Is this some sort of forewarning for the rest of the summer that we're going to have? Should we go out and buy some sort of
system? You know, the seasonal forecasts are for a warmer than normal and dry, and especially drier than normal summer. Now, that doesn't mean we'll necessarily have, you know, heat waves like this every week or anything like that. But it is a sign, of course, that, you know, it's shaping up to be an earlier summer than we've had the last few years.
Well, and if we start to complain, some people like to complain when it gets that hot. Steve Duno is still in the studio with me, shaking his head. He won't complain. But we should remember that these temperatures pale in comparison to what the desert Southwest is getting.
Yeah, and there it's really alarming. Some of the temperatures in places like Las Vegas and Phoenix over the weekend, 115, 116. Death Valley pushing 130.
Oh.
And the minimum temperatures at night in some of those urban areas just down to 90 or even the mid-90s. And that's especially significant because from a human health impact, there's some recent research that has shown that what really matters is the nighttime temperatures. And apparently when there's less relief from the thermal stresses accumulated during the day, that's when people get into trouble. And so long heat waves and ones with hot nights, there are hospitalizations and mortality.
Hmm. Do you want to make a prediction yet about the 4th of July?
Well, I was afraid you were going to ask that. And it's kind of a tricky one. The information a day ago or something was that midweek next week, there'd be some relief from the kind of torrid temperatures. Now it looks like it's going to be kind of getting down into the 80s, but just a minimal marine influence. So I think you have to go with a low to mid 80s on the 4th. More sane weather by next weekend, the high 70s, maybe 80. But right now it looks to be on the warm side.
Well, at least it won't be raining during the fireworks.
Well, no.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. Joins us every Friday for a look at the weather. Coming up, hot temperatures and the news and review roundtable. Stay with us.
And you never know, things might get heated in that news and review roundtable, so stand by. It's 9:59. Washington State's about to have a stronger DUI law, but the bill's sponsor wants to make it even tougher next year. We'll hear more about that in just a couple minutes here. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend. The 2013 lineup includes local band Death Cab for Cutie, playing transatlanticism, heart, and more. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
This week, Wait Wait goes to St. Louis, which according to the Supreme Court is now the capital of the United States. Hey, they changed the Voting Rights Act. Why not this? We'll be talking gay marriage, global warming, and playing our quiz with Olympian Jackie Joyner-Kersee. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz that awards gold medals for knowledge.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.